When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Radio for a really great future.
We're talking real money.
One of our big topics, one of the big topics of the show, is diversification. We talk about diversification for one reason, really. One reason: to reduce risk. That's what diversification is all about. Because we believe, and matter of fact, based on the science, we kind of know. In fact, based on common sense, we really should know that if you have an amazingly well-diversified portfolio, I'm just making new words up. If you have a well-diversified portfolio, then you cannot, for all intents and purposes, lose all your money. You just can't. Okay. You know, that one weird call we had where the guy said the banking crisis and they'll take all our stocks away, which isn't true anyway. But, you know, if the whole economy of the entire world fails, yes, you could lose all your money. But really, will you care about your money at that point? I doubt it. Anyway, we believe you need to be diversified. But how much diversification is enough? And we're mainly talking about diversification in the stock market, because in the bond market, technically, you don't really need a lot, particularly if you use government bonds. You could get by with a bond if you have government bonds. You don't need diversification there. With corporates, another story, you probably should. But with stocks, that's where diversification comes in. It turns risk of loss into merely volatility. And that's bouncing around. How much diversification do you need? There are a number of opinions on this. We think we have the right answer, of course, because we're smarter than everyone else. But what is the right amount, Tom?
Yeah, and as a guy who actually reads a newspaper.
What? What? That is paper. Wait a minute. What is that made of?
Yeah, exactly.
That's an amazing material.
I got a lot of trees in my backyard.
My iPad doesn't fold like that.
Yeah. And every Sunday in the Seattle Times, they run a column called Ask the Fool, the Motley Fool, every Sunday, useful tips on investing. And this week, someone asked the Motley Fool.
I think that's a typo, isn't it?
What's
useful
the best,
or useless?
What's the best number of stocks to own? The answer was the Don McDonald answer. It depends. The fewer you own, wrote Motley Fool, the greater impact each stock may have on your portfolio for good or bad.
Ooh,
the
more you own, they're right. Wait, they're yep. right.
The okay. more you own, the less risk there is of having too many eggs in one basket.
Yay.
For best results, you should keep up with the stocks you buy so you can notice if and when they no longer inspire confidence.
Okay, hold on. Stop. What? Say that again.
Best results, you should keep up with the stocks you buy so you can notice if and when they no longer inspire confidence.
Wait. Did they explain how keeping up with them tells you when they no longer inspire confidence?
I was getting to that. That means ideally, reading their quarterly and annual reports and following them in the news.
And okay, how will that tell me they're going to go down? Because by the time I read the news, the stock will have already moved because somebody, I guarantee, knew it before I did.
Especially if you have to wait until arrives on your doorstep.
That stuff, that doesn't just change automatically with the internet, does it?
No, it doesn't. Going on, sometimes a great performing stock can come to dominate your portfolio. If, for example, one stock has grown to represent 50% of your portfolio's value, you'll have a lot riding on that one company. That's the Department of Obvious Redundancy.
Out of balance portfolio. Yeah. Okay, got it.
You might consider selling some shares and moving that money into another stock in which you have great confidence, perhaps one you already own.
Rebalancing. Okay, got it.
Here's the part that, you know what? On Sundays, I try to lower my blood pressure a little bit and take it easy. But this one jumped it right up, probably jumped right out of the chair. Here's the quote. aiming to own at least 25 stocks can keep you diversified. 25 stocks keep you diversified. So interestingly enough, I thought, well, wait a minute, that seems crazy to me, literally. But then I started thinking, now Jim Cramer on CNBC has told people, yeah, 25 to 30 stocks, you're diversified. Mm-hmm. So I typed in on the internet. You'd been proud of me. I did this on my own.
Wait, you, wait.
I know.
Wait,
I did the search, the whole thing.
Newspaper boy?
I know.
And use the electronic media form?
I didn't have to have my Gen Z, Y, X, what any of those people come in. I did this on my own. Typed it in and everything. I typed in.
Our boy is growing up.
Are you diversified owning 25 stocks? And guess what?
Everybody said yes.
Yes, they did. I mean, from Forbes. Well, nobody reads Forbes anymore. But all these other, sorry, Forbes.
Nobody
all
reads these other, most of those sorry, things Steve. Anymore.
No, but on site after site after site, because I was like, nobody thinks that, really? So then I thought, okay, I'll take the search one step further. I'll type that in and put academics afterward. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Does Eugene Palma believe that?
Oh, clever.
Or French, do they believe that? Wow. Or
you're almost like AI.
Well, almost. It's the almost part that's troubling. And I could find no sites then, because none of them agree with the idiotic idea, the outdated, the 18th century idea that you pick the stocks that you, what does it say, have great confidence in, and buy those and make a lot of money, because that's a fool's errand. Nobody knows those stocks. And I guarantee you, the people that own Amazon, they probably don't know how Amazon makes most of their money. Here's a hint. It's not delivering packages. They don't know those companies, and they don't know what to look for that would be a material change in those companies and be ahead of it enough in any way that would prevent them from taking a huge loss on one firm. And there's been great companies. And I used to follow Microsoft when I had a television show in Seattle and got to interview the guy named Steve Ballmer running the place at the time. Nobody ever expected a decade where the stock price would be underwater. No one knows these things are coming. This is silly, absolutely silly. But I was stunned the number of websites that said, yeah, sure, 20 to 25 stocks is diversification.
And just to make a point, not too long ago, I put together a presentation several years ago where I looked at a portfolio of the best telecommunications company, named by many as the best telecommunications, the best transportation company, the best utility company in the country.
Airline.
You know, I a bunch of these stocks, and built this wonderful portfolio of these hot stocks. I think it was five altogether, maybe.
I believe you're correct. Yeah.
And they all went broke, filed for bankruptcy, lost investors every penny. So five out of 25 could have, if you picked the wrong five, gone to zero. And that's a permanent 20% loss.
And beyond that, Herr Hendrik Bessenbinder, his work found
Arizona State.
Yeah. Found that only 2% of the stocks out there actually made enough more than T-bills to sort of project. That's what made money in the markets for the last, I forget, was it like going back to 1926 or something, way back when?
So if your 25 stocks did not include that 2%,
you made T-bill
then your
rates.
Return wouldn't have been any better than Treasury bills. You see, this is the thing that they don't mention, that people like the fool don't mention, because they need you, as does Jim Cramer. Consider the source of their income. They need you to want to pick stocks, because that's how they make their money, telling you which stocks to pick.
And you
they
pay
need
attention.
You to pick them.
Yeah.
Now, what is adequate diversification according to the academics?
Yeah. And this is, I think, something worth paying attention to. You mentioned the name Eugene Fama, who won a Nobel Prize in 2013 for his efficient market theory, which basically held nobody knows anything about the future of stock prices, and that's a random event. But most academics are going to tell you, by the way, which is going to be matched by advice from a guy named Warren Buffett, that just owning the market is diversification. And what is owning the market? Well, owning the market, the problem with owning 25 stocks is you're going to miss like 10 markets. You're not going to have U.S. large cap value. Probably you might, but you're not going to have U.S. small growth. You're not going to have U.S. small value, correct? I mean, those aren't going to be in your portfolio because 25 unlikely. Stocks only makes out the mm-hmm. big companies that you know of. You're not going to have any international, so you're not going to have international large growth, international large value, international small growth, international small value. You won't have REITs in there. You won't have emerging markets, growth, value, size, et cetera. You've been missing a ton of markets. Places that have had a huge return over time and added to your wealth, but you will own none of those, absolutely none. And you could go through a period of time, we've talked about this on the podcast previously, where if you just own 25 large companies, you're going to go a decade with negative return as the S&P 500 did basically in the aughts, right? 2000 through 2009. So this is a really bad piece of advice. And this is not the first time that we picked on Motley Fool, and deservedly so. And by the way, Motley Fool, what you didn't finish your thought on was when you read their online stuff and they have something that might be of value, it always takes you to the four stocks you have to buy today and get our research guy because he's going to tell you how to make 25,000.
They make their money.
Exactly. So it's really awful advice. Diversification should be a globally diversified portfolio. If you can,
and the number of stocks.
Yeah, right. Okay.
The number of stocks. I mean, the S&P 500. Nope, not enough. 500 stocks, not enough, because you're still missing a lot of the world and a lot of segments of the economy. The plain vanilla doesn't get real small cap, doesn't get real crazy with emerging markets, mainly large company, but with some small, they're The total portfolio of Vanguard Total Market Index is 9,800 stocks.
Which is pretty good, actually.
9,800 stocks.
Yeah, that's good.
But I got to tell you, AVGE probably has, I don't have the exact number because it's made up of buku funds. It's a
yeah,
fund
I think it
funds.
Has six funds in it, seven
it
maybe?
Has, oh, no, more than that. It has.
Does it? Okay.
It has.
AVGE is
funds.
15, the Avantis Global Equity Fund. One fund holds a massively diversified portfolio.
Yeah, it's probably, last I looked at a similar portfolio, it was around 12,000 stocks.
So what do you get when you diversify that? I mean, the question always is, well, my diversifying...
You get the planet.
But am I diversifying away my returns? In other words, I'm not just in the stocks that only go up. And we're going to tell
yeah,
you,
but you're going to
we don't
sure
know those.
Be in those 2% that do
yeah,
go
that's
up
true.
The most.
Yeah. Have made more over the long haul than T-bills. But you, what you said is exactly right. I view myself as an investor, as an aggressive chicken, because I've said this before, 80% of my money is in stocks, but I hedge that by not overweighting it to the ones that I think will do better because I don't know which ones will do better. I got a hunch, but I ain't going to put my money that way. I'm going to move it out. Spread it around. So,
well,
I given like
your
the aggressive
last name,
chicken.
At least you're a rooster.
Exactly. Chicken, cock, it's all the same. Anyway, I mean, so, but this is one piece of advice
either
that
way,
shocked me. It shocks me because it's one of those things you think people, everybody takes for granted when we say it. Yeah, to be diversified. Because basically, when every person comes in and does a review with us, they say, oh, I'm diversified. And then we look at their portfolio, well, not really. Because you don't own this, you don't own this, you don't you have a little tiny
and
bit of
yet,
that. So,
and yet you don't need to own more than one fund to be massively diversified. One.
It is shocking how easy it is to do in today's world. There's no doubt about that.
And the cost is negligible. It's so cheap. Vanguard, a VT, the Vanguard Total World Stock Index, is probably the cheapest way to own a diversified global portfolio, and its expense ratio, this is an ETF, which means their expenses are low, is 0.07%.
Which is cheap. By the way, you said because it's an ETF, it means its expenses are low.
It's,
not every
its expenses
ETF
are low. No,
not every ETF has cheaper expenses.
No, but it should be because it's cheaper to manage than a mutual fund. So it should be
good
cheaper
point.
Than their mutual fund.
VT
WAX by comparison, VTWAX, which is the Vanguard Total World Stock Index Admiral, is 30% more expensive.
That's an outrage.
Yeah, it's 0.1%.
Crazy, man. Crazy. I just talked to somebody today that has almost all of their money in fixed income using ETFs, but the average expense ratio for the bond funds was about 0.75. That's just too high. That's
for
too
bonds?
High. Yeah, for bonds.
It's bonds really, should be the cheapest thing in your portfolio.
Shouldn't have added up. All right, we got time for a couple questions.
I hope so, because that's why I do this.
I know. This comes from Jordan in Enumclaw, Washington.
Okay.
Hi, Don and Tom. I'm in my mid-20s and have used a debit card for almost all my transactions up to this point. I have a simple credit union credit card that I use occasionally, but it has a relatively small limit, $1,500, and no rewards. I've been considering opening a credit card with a higher limit that offers cash back or some other useful rewards. There's so many options out there. What would you recommend looking for in a credit card? Do you recommend a specific card? The Don McDonald card. Never leave home without it.
You know, I'm the guy you should ask, because I chase.
How many do you have now?
I chase points. I do.
I have two locked up in my safe in my house. I don't use them.
So. Now, my number one go-to get a great deal card is the Costco City Visa.
Gee, I don't have that.
Because with my Costco membership and this, I get like 3% back on everything.
And do you spend $2,000 a year at Costco?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay. I ask a lot of couples, and they're like, no, and unless you spend that much, the membership doesn't make sense to me. Anyway.
I make it a point to look for a Costco to get gas everywhere I go.
That's a good idea. Since I only buy gas once every 6 weeks now. So
well, now that I have the giant trailer puller.
You're going to be filling her up there, son. All right. If you're not a Costco member, let me tell you
the other ones I like.
He's actually pulling the cards out right now. Would you read us back the numbers, please, sir?
Yeah. So the other ones I like, for example, when we travel, if you're loyal to a brand, then you should probably have that brand's credit card. I am loyal to Delta as an airline and Marriott as a hotel. So I have both of their cards that I have at times used to help me get status. You know, if you buy a certain amount, you can get actual kick up in your medallion status at Delta and things like that.
You used to be able to go to the little lounge there that Delta had, right?
Well, I still do. I still do, which is not the best deal. But because I have a Delta Amex, and I go for the expensive one because
I'm gonna roll you when you get to my parking lot and go for a spree,
the
man.
The Delta Amex, the reserve one, which is not cheap. It's like $600 a year, but it gets me $300 back on food. It gets me tons of Delta points when I use it for Delta.
Okay, this is very confusing.
No, it's not.
He said not nine cards.
I'm giving him some options.
What about like Chase?
And the Delta card, let me tell you, the Delta card gives you the Delta Amex card gives you President's Club status at Hertz, which is really nice. Anyway, what about Chase? They're branded. Chase is big on branded cards.
I use theirs for travel because I get so many, I forget, it's pretty good on the points thing from what I can tell.
Yeah, I have a Capital One card that I used once just to get a ton of points. Sometimes I just get a card and use it to get a ton of points.
But if he's going to go one place and go get a card today.
Well, I can't. There isn't one. It depends on you.
Jordan needs a card.
That's why I give him. That's why I'm giving him choices, because it's not one size fits all. There is not a one size fits all card. It depends.
Which you're going to use your card to buy, apparently. Okay.
Exactly. It depends on where your loyalties lie, because you can really, really, really multiply the effect of the card if you travel a lot.
Can you go look at Bankrate, for example? Do they have credit cards there? You can look at deals?
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
So you could go see what the points are.
I like the points guys or the points guy.
Yeah.
Is it the points guy?
Oh, I see the points. I mean, for example, my Chase, which I try to use for all travel stuff now, gives me all those. And then I use those rewards to give gifts for people's birthdays and Christmas, that stuff. I get gift cards, which I hope they use. But
well, anyway. we're our Marriott card. We're going to go one of these days, spend a week at the Ritz-Carlton at Amelia for free. We have so many points.
Amelia? You mean
Amelia
the pilot?
Amelia Island.
She has her own island?
Yeah,
she survived.
It's just a lovely, lovely place.
Okay.
Amelia Island's really nice. Anyway,
move on.
Next question.
Mike, from Grays Lake, Illinois. My wife and I are in our mid-50s, have no children. We're working through our retirement plan. Everything is falling into place. That's great to hear, Mike. However, one of the biggest remaining anxieties is trying to figure out how to find professional support to manage my wife's finances, healthcare assets, etc., after I'm gone, he says, just playing the odds. And when she gets to the point, she can no longer manage it on her own. Do you have any suggestions of how and where to start looking for professional help for a surviving spouse who may become physically or mentally unable to manage on their own?
This is why we say you at a certain point in life, it starts to having a fee-only, 100% fiduciary advisor for the family, the couples, start to make sense because life gets more complicated, and this is part of that equation. The fact is, if you have a pre-existing relationship with an advisor, then it will be, there'll be no transition. Everything will, because you will have already planned all of that.
I love it for that exact reason. Even if you're a great do-it-yourself investor and you have a plan, for the reason you just mentioned. So I'll say it. I have an advisor and right now I'm keeping track of stuff my own, but one day when I'm gone, I suspect my wife will live on. Because Don will have killed me
30 years after you.
Don will have killed me earlier through some method. And the expectation is the advisor will keep her on the right track for one thing. Cause this is not the area my wife thinks about at all. It's just not her priority. And then manage the money properly so that it's taken care of and will sustain her. So yeah, I think it's good, but okay. But I think, don't we still have a list on our website or something that we can people go look at for various names?
Yeah, some. But really the thing you want to do is get that form, the advisor interview form. It's all at talkingrealmoney.com/help.
That's right.
Talkingrealmoney.com/help.
And there we have a form. We want anyone you're thinking of hiring to read, sign, because then you know you're getting 100% fee-only fiduciary help.
And a lot of people will refuse to sign it.
They will. People have come back and told us, my guy says no.
Yep.
My guy's name is Ed, and he ain't going to do it.
If your guy won't sign it, then your guy isn't a fiduciary all
might
the time.
Might be cheating on you. Never know.
Might be lying to you.
Yeah. Mm. Pay attention.
All right. I think that was fun.
Thank you so much. That was awesome. Loved every minute of it.
Another great episode in the can, on the books, ready to put on the podcast and share with all of America. Nay, even the world. And we appreciate you being there. We hope you tell a friend or 1,000. And questions, let us know. Just go to talkingrealmoney.com, click the contact form, and that'll ferry your questions right to us. I am Don McDonald. Over there is Tom Cock, the Rooster. The Rooster King.
I was so going to do a cock-a-doodle-doo, but I'm not going to, so.
I'll just do this.
I'm an aggressive chicken.
Anyway, what were we going to do? Oh, we are. We're here all the time talking chicken. No? What?
Eating chicken, talking real money.
The opinions and views expressed on this podcast were current on the date recorded. Opinions, estimates, forecasts, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice, including any forward-looking estimates or statements which are based on certain expectations and assumptions. Although information and opinions given have been obtained from or based on sources believed to be reliable, no warranty or representation is made as to their correctness, completeness, or accuracy. Information presented on the podcast is not personalized investment advice from Appella Wealth. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for everyone. This podcast does not identify all the risks, direct or indirect, or other considerations which might be material to you when entering any financial transaction. Past performance does not guarantee future results, and profitable results cannot be guaranteed. We hope you realize that the information provided on Talking Real Money is for informational, educational, and hopefully enjoyable purposes only. The podcast is not trying to get you to buy or sell any financial products or securities. Instead, the program is provided as a public service by Appella Wealth, a fee-only registered investment advisor. Please see Appella Wealth ADV Part 2A on our website for information regarding Appella's fees and services. Appella Capital, LLC, DBA Appella Wealth, is an investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The firm only transacts business in the states where it is properly registered or excluded or exempt from registration requirements. Registration with the SEC or any state securities authority does not imply a certain level of skill or training. Appella does not provide tax or legal advice, and nothing either stated or implied here should be inferred as providing such advice. Thanks for listening, and please visit TalkingRealMoney.com for more information and important disclosure related to performance of any specific index or fund quoted in this podcast.
And the lawyers get richer.